Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. The financial toll. Inflation slows, but high prices across the U.S. economy are still squeezing many Americans, especially households of color. Then, assassination plot. The Justice Department charges an Iranian man with trying to kill former National Security Advisor John Bolton. And the Biden agenda. We take an in-depth look at the billions of dollars the Democrats' major budget bill provides to an understaffed IRS.
When you underfund the IRS, it's really a tax cut for tax cheats. So the IRS, with this funding, is going to be able to be more focused on the people who are actually non-compliant.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. Inflation in the U.S. has eased, at least modestly, for the first time in months. The Labor Department reports that consumer prices were up 8.5% in July from a year ago. Still, that was slower than the 9.1% jump in June from the previous year. And on a monthly basis, there was no net increase from June to July, as President Biden noted at the White House.
Today, we received news that our economy had 0% inflation in the month of July. 0%. Here's what that means. While the price of some things went up last month, the price of other things went down by the same amount. The result, zero inflation last month, but people are still hurting.
We'll take a closer look at inflation's effects later in the program. Former President Trump says that he refused today to answer questions in a civil investigation of his real estate dealings. He traveled to the office of the New York State Attorney General in Manhattan and left 6 hours later. He said he invoked his right against self-incrimination. In a statement, he said, quote, "The raid of my home, Mar-a-Lago, on Monday by the FBI wiped out any uncertainty. I have absolutely no choice," end quote. The Mar-a-Lago search was unrelated to the New York investigation. The U.S. Justice Department has charged an Iranian national with targeting John Bolton for assassination. Bolton was a one-time national security advisor to then-President Trump. Federal officials say that a member of Iran's Revolutionary Guard tried to hire a hitman to kill Bolton. We'll return to this after the news summary. China announced today that it is winding down military drills around Taiwan. The war games saw Chinese ships and planes crossing into Taiwanese waters and airspace. China said today that it will continue regular patrols in the area. In Beijing, officials again cited the Taiwan visit by Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives.
"Every time the U.S. side makes a serious provocative act of infringing on China's sovereignty, the Chinese side will resolutely fight back. China will never allow its sovereignty and territorial integrity to be wantonly trampled on."
Speaker Pelosi said today that China used her trip as an excuse to make aggressive new moves in the region. Kenya waited today for results from Tuesday's presidential election. As ballot counting continued, some early tallies showed Deputy President William Ruto leading with just over 50% of the vote. Human rights groups urged calm and warned of false claims about the vote circulating on social media. Back in this country, Trump supporters have scored more primary wins. Republicans who reject the 2020 election results were nominated on Tuesday in Wisconsin and Minnesota for offices that could oversee elections. Also in Wisconsin, Trump-endorsed candidate Tim Michaels won the GOP gubernatorial nomination. And in Washington state, Congresswoman Jamie Herrera Butler conceded defeat in last week's Republican primary. She had voted to impeach Mr. Trump after the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. President Biden signed a bill today to expand benefits for military veterans exposed to toxic burn pits. They were used in Iraq and Afghanistan to dispose of chemicals, plastics, and human waste. The bill also expands a number of existing health care benefits for veterans. And on Wall Street, stocks advanced on the news that inflation backed off a bit in July. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 535 points to close at 33,309, up 1.6%. The NASDAQ rose nearly 3%. The S&P 500 was up 2%. Still to come on the NewsHour, could there be an electoral opportunity for Democrats in the battle over abortion and other social issues? Patriotic tattoos become a liability for Ukrainians as the Russian invasion grinds on. Abandoned oil and natural gas wells pollute the environment across Louisiana, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
As we reported, the Department of Justice has charged an Iranian with trying to assassinate former National Security Advisor John Bolton. U.S. officials say the man was a member of Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps. Nick Schifrin is following this, and he joins me here. So, hello, Nick. What do we know about this plot?
U.S. officials say beginning in about October 2021, an Iranian named Shahram Poursafi, that is his FBI wanted poster, began to take steps to assassinate Bolton. And you can see they're both on the left and the right, Poursafi in uniform. That, DOJ says, is part of the evidence that he was a member of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps' Quds Force. That's the unit that oversees operation, is really the military wing of the regime. DOJ says Poursafi hired a person in the U.S. that DOJ identifies as a confidential human source to the U.S., offered him first $250,000, then after negotiation, $300,000 in digital currency to hire someone to assassinate John Bolton. The person in the U.S. said that, yes, he had hired someone, a member of a Mexican cartel, and Poursafi said that he wanted Bolton to be killed by the end of 2021. And at one point, Poursafi even messaged this person in the U.S. a photo of the cash that he was offering. The FBI was able to get inside of Poursafi's messaging apps. Here's how Matt Olson, the Assistant Attorney General for National Security, described it earlier today.
This was not an idle threat. And this is not the first time we have uncovered brazen acts by Iran to exact revenge against individuals on U.S. soil. We will work tirelessly to continue to expose and disrupt every one of these efforts.
And that is a reference to a previous Iranian plot to assassinate the former Saudi ambassador in the U.S. Bottom line, Judy, Justice, the FBI took this plot very seriously, even though the person that Poursafi thought he was hiring to hire a hitman was, in fact, an FBI informant.
And Nick, what is the government saying about why they believe the Revolutionary Guard was targeting Bolton?
Poursafi and this official in the U.S. talked about Qasem Soleimani. This is the former head of the Quds Force, who was killed in a U.S. drone strike on January 3rd, 2020. Iran has been very clear that it wanted revenge for Soleimani's death, especially by killing individual Americans, something that Bolton told me earlier today when we spoke.
It was very serious, and I don't think it was John Bolton alone that was the target here. I think there were many former administration officials, but also private American citizens. And it really tells you the real nature of the regime in Tehran, that they are threatening American citizens on American soil.
A former senior official tells me that Iran identified five specific former officials to assassinate: former President Trump, former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, Bolton, the former top commander in the Middle East, General Frank McKenzie, who was in charge of all military, U.S. military in the Middle East, and Brian Hook, the former special envoy for Iran. And in fact, Poursafi specifically said there was going to be a second target for which he was willing to pay $1 million to assassinate, and that, quote, his time would come. U.S. officials say the threat is very much active today, Judy.
Well, that's disturbing. So, Nick, all this happens as the administration is just about to re-enter these nuclear talks on Iran's nuclear program. How is it thought that this is going to affect all that?
U.S. officials say it will not affect those talks. A White House spokesperson tells me today that President Biden still believes diplomacy is the best path to prevent Iran from acquiring a nuclear weapon. Their argument is that the U.S. will deal with Iran's other destabilizing behavior, the largest ballistic missile program in the Middle East, Iran's support for proxies and terrorism across the region, but separately want to put the Iranian nuclear program, so to speak, in a kind of box. Bolton, however, and others disagree.
Iran's nuclear weapons program and its terrorist activities are two sides of the same coin. You can't separate one from the other. They are endemic to the regime in Tehran. That was the mistake of the 2015 deal. It's the mistake in trying to go back into it.
But what the administration argues is that it's actually easier to deal with those other aspects of Iran's malign activity in the Middle East if Iran's nuclear program is constrained, and that's what they will continue to do. As for the talks, Judy, senior U.S. officials tell me that they've actually made a lot of progress in the last few months. They've jumped over the kind of major hurdles that they had at the beginning of the deal, which steps the U.S. would take in order to lift the sanctions on Iran, and which steps Iran had to take to get back into compliance when it comes to its nuclear program. But the two sides are disagreeing still to this day over whether the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, can investigate Iran's previous attempts to try and create a nuclear program, those attempts, of course, that Iran concealed from the world. There is a final text on the table, Judy, and we may know within just a couple days whether there might, there could be a deal or not.
Timing of this very interesting. John Bolton, of course, longtime opponent of any nuclear deal with
Absolutely.
Iran. Nick Schifrin, thank you very much.
Thank you.
From President Biden's recent legislative victories to the overwhelming victory for abortion rights in Kansas and the FBI's search of Mar-a-Lago, August so far has been full of surprises. And with some 90 days to go before the November midterm elections, it's not clear if such events will influence how Americans cast their votes this fall. Senator Tim Scott, Republican from South Carolina, is up for re-election in November. His new book, America, A Redemption Story, is out this week, and he joins me now. Senator Scott, congratulations on the book and welcome to the NewsHour. Thank you for
Thank
being
you.
Here.
Yes, ma'am. It's good to be with you.
So I want to ask you about the book, but
yes,
I
ma'am.
Also want to ask you just a couple of questions about former President Trump. He's very much in the news, this search by the FBI
yes,
of his
ma'am.
Home in Palm Beach. Your comments, among other things, you said, let's see how the facts play out. Let the facts play out. I've been looking at social media, and some supporters of the former president are saying you should be more aggressively supporting him. What are you saying to them?
Well, I do think that my comments are really important. Number one, I was saying to my friends on the other side of the aisle, as opposed to rushing to judgment as they did in the Russia collusion episode, be patient. I would say to the rest of the country, we should be alarmed at the way that the Department of Justice and the FBI have gone after someone. This is unprecedented. It is shocking and quite surprising.
And we're waiting to see what happens. The Trump, we are told that the Trump attorneys have a list of what was taken out of the Mar-a-Lago estate, but we haven't seen that yet. The other thing I want to ask you about is former President Trump today appearing before the New York State Attorney General answering questions about his real estate dealings. He spent hours there, and he said afterwards he didn't answer any questions, invoke the Fifth. Should he have answered those questions?
If I were his attorney, I would probably tell him not to say a word to anyone from the Department of Justice anytime soon. I think he's protecting himself, and frankly, if I were in his seat or his lawyers, I would be very concerned about getting a fair shake from this Department of Justice.
Well, let's turn to your book.
Yes, ma'am.
The title, as we said, it's America, A Redemption Story, Choosing Hope, Creating Unity. It's your story, but it's also the story of others. Why did you want to say that what you're saying in this book right now?
I think our country faces polarization and skepticism about whether or not America works together. I wanted to be emphatic about the fact that I believe that we've been evolving in the right direction, that in my life, much like America's, we've had challenges. We've faced our original sin of racism. We had a civil war to solve that issue. We're continuing to work on it. My personal life, my eighth grade year, I was facing a race riot at the high school. 4 years later, I'm elected the student government president. The one thing about America is that we're the solution. Sometimes it's hard to get there, but we always arrive at the right place. I'm very confident that working together, we can get things done.
Your call for America to work together seems to be one of the lone voices at a time of great division in this country.
Yes,
do you
ma'am.
Think people are ready to hear that message, and especially in the Republican Party?
I certainly hope so. I believe that division and polarization is not a Republican thing or a Democrat thing. It's a human thing. So my thought is, in my book, America, a Redemption Story, I talk about how good people of good intention, our good conscience, came together and helped me form a foundation, how to think for myself as opposed to what think. What to think. In today's environment, it feels like people are being indoctrinated as opposed to saying, think for yourself, come to your own conclusions, wait patiently for all the information, and then make a decision.
And how do you think that's being received? I mean, you're talking to your fellow Republican senators and other members of Congress.
I'm on both sides of the aisle. I do believe that today you look at some of the polarization that we have around the country today, it's not because of Republicans as much as it is about the administration's inability to be the great uniter that he campaigned on, President Biden. We have a big responsibility of bringing this country together. I believe we can get it done. It will take both sides of the aisle, but more importantly, it will take individuals embracing the concept that America's better together, leaning into opportunities. I write about it in my book about some of the people that came together. I had a wonderful mentor and a great orthodontist who changed my smile and my self-esteem permanently. And I thank God for people who had the opportunity, and they did because they wanted to.
You have been, you created a political committee called the Opportunity. The Opportunity Zone.
Yes, ma'am. Opportunity Matters.
Opportunity Matters. And you're paying for ads, supporting your fellow Republicans around the country. We looked at a number of them, including one in Wisconsin for Senator Ron Johnson. And I listened to it today, and I noticed you said we need new leadership in Washington. Of course, Senator Johnson served 12 years. He's running for a third term. So how do you see that?
Yeah, so easily. One of the things that Ron John brings to the table is he's a small business owner. Here's a person who understands how to sign the front of the paycheck and not just the back of the paycheck. Washington has lots of lawyers, but not a lot of business people. So I feel like having someone like him is the new brand of leadership that is so important for those of us who understand how to run a business, hiring people, and the red tape or the headwinds that comes from the government.
And I'm asking because he has served two terms.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, sir. The new brand of leadership.
He'd be serving for another six. You are also sending out requests for people to donate to your campaign, and we looked at some of what you're asking for. And you, among other things, you say Democrats want abortions at 52 weeks.
Yes, ma'am.
We know the normal human term for an abortion
for
pregnancy is 40 weeks.
Of course.
52 weeks is a whole year. So I'm curious, which Democrats are calling for 52 weeks?
Well, what we were talking about was Governor Northam's comments about infanticide, that literally up to the day of birth, one can be aborted. I think that is unconscionable. Frankly, there are seven countries on earth that allow for late-term abortions in the way that we do in this country. And so we were trying to use a hyperbolic approach to bring more attention to the fact that there are late-term abortions, as well as people in the governing world that seems to think or believe that you could have an abortion up until the day of birth.
But you're not saying that Democrats want a baby. When you say infanticide, I mean, it sounds like you're saying Democrats want babies to die after they're...
I'm not suggesting that all of the Democrats want anything. I'm suggesting that Governor Northam made comments that were consistent with the latest term of abortions happening in the latest part of the pregnancy.
But you're not saying that's what most Democrats
want? Oh, of course not. No, we would never whitewash everyone into the same category.
And finally, Senator, you've commented on this, but there is a paragraph in your book on the copyright page talking about you're running for president, that
yes,
this
ma'am.
Is a statement that prepares you to run for president.
Yes.
How seriously are you thinking about that?
Well, Chapter 5, I do talk about becoming president of my student government, and certainly my publishers were ambitious in thinking that there was a presidential election this year. I think they were way off there, and fortunately, they issued an apology for making such a drastic mistake. My goal is a very simple goal. That's running for re-election to continue to serve the great people of South Carolina. And while I find it humorous that I have a chapter about being president of my student government and my publishers had a comment that I did not approve, the most important thing to focus on is what's now.
But it's something you're open to in the future.
You never know what's going to happen, but I certainly am open to being re-elected.
All right. Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina, the book is America, a redemption story. Thank you very much.
Yes, ma'am. Good to be with you.
Even though new data today show that inflation is slowing, many prices remain high, and the most vulnerable Americans are bearing the brunt. William Brangham has more on who is being hit hardest.
Judy, new data shows inflation has had an outsized negative impact on Native American, Black, and Latino families in particular. A poll out this week from NPR, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and Harvard found 69% of Native Americans say inflation has caused serious financial problems, as do 58% of Black Americans and 56% of Latinos. Just 44% of white and 36% of Asian households report similar hardships. Alonzo Plow is the chief science officer of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and he was involved in this research. The foundation is one of the NewsHour's funders. Mr. Plow, very good to have you on the NewsHour. I mean, we have been tracking how a lot of Americans across the spectrum have been hurt by inflation, but these communities seem to be really suffering disproportionately. Why is that?
Well, while inflation influences and affects all of us, these are communities, the Black, Indigenous, Latino populations, who are economically marginal in the best of time. So one has to think about inflation as just amplifying a situation of almost survival economics in the best of time for these groups. The impact goes from being difficult in terms of your economic status to barely being able to make it. Trade-offs like not paying rent, not being able to get health care, and actually food insecurity. So the effects are immediate and much more severe than most of us are facing with inflation.
It seems similar to the way in which COVID, again, revealed all of these inequities that we knew existed in our society, but it highlighted them in such stark relief. Inflation seems to be doing exactly the same thing.
The analogy with COVID is exactly right. COVID pointed out long-standing disparities. And again, it's very important to point out that these are not based on people's race, but the effect of racism that creates a variety of marginalizing factors, housing that's insecure, neighborhoods that are not safe, lack of health insurance. Generations of that is going to put our populations at greater risk for any kind of problem, be it COVID or inflation.
One particular fact jumped out. I mean, a whole bunch of them did. But this one, a third of Black and Latino families were saying that they had a hard time affording food. Almost 40% of Indigenous families said the same thing. How should we interpret that? I mean, that is very, very difficult to cut back on feeding your family.
We should interpret that these are people who are at the borderline of survival on a day-to-day basis. So food insecurity is a way of life. Trade-offs are being made all the time between health care, paying rent, packing a lunch for your kid at school. And again, a situation like inflation, again, just tips you into more of a precarious situation. That's a chronic problem, and it's unfortunate when that is only elevated in the context of COVID disparities or inflation disparities.
Another similar fact, just to the point that you're saying, that majorities in each of these communities were saying they didn't have enough savings to bridge 1 month of their normal expenses. And if you think about that, of a family not being able to have enough in the bank to bridge a month of their expenses, I mean, that is truly living on the edge.
Yes, family, again, these are minimum wage earning families are living on the edge. All data show that there are scarce, if any, savings. And then another long-term impact of marginalization is lack of transgenerational wealth families. Our polling showed that majority populations had family members had helped them out, other generations. But that's not the case when there has been income inequality, again, for generations in our Black, Brown, and Indigenous populations.
I mean, we are seeing some signs that inflation is starting to wane slightly. For these families, does that give you a sense that, okay, this might turn around for them, or do you worry that the setbacks that they've suffered during this inflationary period might just mean they're going to continue falling behind?
I wish I could be more optimistic, but I'm not. These are families who have been economically marginalized throughout their life course. Those kinds of conditions in place that create daily trade-offs between whether you can afford food, whether you can afford gas in the car, those will continue. And it's just unfortunate that we need a survey like this to point out a problem that should be discussed every day. Large percentages of our population are really living at the margin and so economically vulnerable.
I mean, this research seems to point out that as far as longer-term solutions to this, I mean, we're talking about very systemic issues in our society. What people get paid, whether they have access to health care, what the social safety net looks like. I mean, those are seemingly very difficult challenges for our leaders to address in the best of times.
Well, our leaders have opportunities to address that. And many of the approaches to deal with these problems of poverty and marginality, I mean, this isn't rocket science. Other countries do it as a standard part of their social welfare programs. Many elements in current legislation that haven't been implemented around daycare, child care, there are many different approaches that have been not found their way sufficiently into current legislation that are remedies for this. So the tragedy is not applying things that we know will work in order to eliminate this kind of disparity.
All right. Alonzo Plow of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
There is a $1 trillion gap between what Americans owe in taxes and what the federal government collects. The Democrats' budget bill that is expected to win final approval in the House this week would unleash funds that could help round up all that missing money. Congressional correspondent Lisa Desjardins has more.
Judy, the so-called Inflation Reduction Act would dramatically increase funding for the IRS, some $80 billion over the next 10 years. Democrats say that gets the agency back on its feet, able to find more tax cheats after years of budget cuts. Republicans say it's dangerous and will target American families for audits. Joining me now to understand more is former IRS Commissioner John Koskinen. Thank you so much for joining us. I want to start with some baseline facts here about the IRS. First of all, since 2010, the IRS has seen significant budget cuts, nearly 20%, and their staff numbers are down about that same amount. The agency currently has about 80,000 full-time staffers for reference. John Koskinen, this bill could double that amount, adding another 80,000 plus staffers over 10 years. Does the IRS really need that many? Is the problem that large?
Well, I'm not sure how they came up with the 80,000 number. Between now and 2031, when the bill expires and the funding expires, anywhere from 35,000 to as many as 50,000 employees will retire because they're eligible to retire. So a lot of them, they'll all have to be replaced. But in terms of the growth of the IRS, I always thought that if I could get back the 20,000 that I lost while I was there, that would be a major step forward.
What is the need then? What have the budget cuts done? What did you see them doing? And what's your understanding now of the agency?
Well, I think this funding is going to be a sea change for the IRS. Obviously, it's a lot more fun to try to figure out how to spend money effectively than to deal with ongoing budget cuts, which has been the situation for the last 10 or 12 years. The IRS won't be starting from scratch. It has a lot of plans in place to improve taxpayer service, to modernize its information technology systems, and to catch up in its enforcement. The audit rate is down by over 50%. So that means a lot of people who should be audited, who are cutting corners or even cheating, are getting away with it because there aren't enough revenue officers and revenue agents. I think basically, though, the people who are going to benefit most from this are taxpayers.
It's interesting because that's Republicans' criticism. They say that all of these new IRS workers, especially the new auditors, could target American families. And I want to play one of the critics. This was Senator Marco Rubio speaking in the Senate chamber over the weekend.
They're going to go after them. They're going to go after the people that cannot afford to hire an army of lawyers and accountants to fight off the IRS agents. Thousands of IRS agents. Well, not police officers to go after criminals, IRS agents to go after American taxpayers. That's who they're going to go after. I promise you, and I regret to say it, that a lot of hardworking people are going to be getting letters in the mail saying, hey, we want to talk to you about your taxes from 5 years ago, from 3 years ago, because we think you might have messed up.
This will mean more audits. Do we know who those audits are likely to hit? How does the IRS approach who it chooses? Hardworking Americans is who Senator Rubio is worried about.
Senator Rubio is off base. It's really a silly argument to say that the IRS is not going to go after hardworking Americans. The vast majority of taxpayers never hear from the IRS. They have simple, straightforward returns with W-2s and maybe a 1099 thrown in. And the IRS's goal is not to audit anybody where there is not going to be a change. They keep track of what's called the no change rate. And the goal is to keep that as minimal as possible, because if there's no change in an audit, not only is it a waste of the taxpayer's time, it's a waste of the IRS's time. So what will happen with the information technology modernization and its increased ability to do data analytics is the IRS will be actually better able to target the people who really should be audited. So I think the vast majority of taxpayers are actually going to benefit by this, because the level of taxpayer service is going to increase significantly.
Part of this gets to the power of the office which you held, the IRS commissioner. The commissioner has said himself, the current commissioner, that they are going to hold, that they are going to be responsible for making sure that folks who earn under $400,000 will not see any increase in their audit rate. What's to say another commissioner couldn't change that and change and decide who they want to target?
Well, you have to remember, there are only two political appointees in the IRS, the commissioner and the chief counsel. Everyone else is a dedicated career employee, and I have a lot of confidence in them. And no one wants to waste time chasing taxpayers who don't owe more money than they've already paid. So that I think it's fair to say that the vast majority of people earning under $400,000 already file appropriate income taxes and never hear from the IRS. Those who are cheating are going to be a little more nervous. I've always said that when you underfund the IRS, it's really a tax cut for tax cheats, because they're the ones who benefit by the lowered rate of enforcements and the lower audit rates. So the IRS, with this funding, is going to be able to be more focused on the people who are actually non-compliant. So the hardworking Americans who are filing appropriate tax returns aren't going to hear any more from the IRS in the future than they've heard in the past.
Democrats are counting on this idea of expanded IRS enforcement to bring in hundreds of billions of dollars. Do you think there is that much money out there in tax cheats that the IRS can't get at now?
When I was there, looking at the audits that were selected to be done that couldn't be done because we didn't have enough people, my estimate was we were leaving $8 to $10 billion a year on the table. That wasn't guessing. That wasn't saying, let's go find some people. Those were people who had returns that had serious questions in them, and we just didn't have enough revenue agents and officers. So I think the revenue projected to be raised by this bill is reasonable, and I think it's probably going to be exceeded over the course of the 8 years.
John Koskinen, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
We're now less than 3 months away from the midterm elections, and as Democrats hope recent legislative successes will bolster them this fall, Republicans are betting they can win back control of Congress by emphasizing economic concerns. Joining me now to discuss all this and more are two pollsters who have teamed up to research voters' attitudes. Joel Benenson is a Democratic strategist who worked on Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton's presidential campaigns. And Neil Newhouse was the lead pollster for Mitt Romney and John McCain's presidential bids. Hello to both of you. Welcome to the NewsHour, your latest polling report. I found it fascinating. So there's a lot to ask you about. Neil Newhouse, let me start with you. As you hear what voters are saying, what did you pick up as the main issues on their minds as they approach these elections?
Judy, first of all, thanks for having us on. It's always a pleasure to talk to you about this stuff. The first and foremost issue people are talking about is the cost of living. Is rising prices, is making ends meet. Americans don't feel their income is going as far as it used to. Gas prices have gone up, grocery prices, and Americans are feeling it. They're cutting back. Something like 80% of Americans say that they have been impacted by the rising costs, and they have had to try to make adjustments. So it is an economic election. It's been that way probably for almost a year now. We first started seeing data like this back in July. And essentially, it hasn't really changed since then. But it's, you know, it's a pocketbook campaign right now, a pocketbook economy. And that's what this election right now is revolving around. Again, with the issue of abortion now surfacing over the last couple of months. So that's certainly what people are talking about as well. But it's economy and then kind of social issues.
Well, and that's what I want to ask you, Joel Benenson. How do you read what voters are saying?
Well, I think there are two things. I have a mantra when it comes to elections. I generally say that they're about big things, not small things. They're about the future, not the past, and it's about their lives, not your life. That doesn't mean candidates' bios don't matter. I think there's a lot more going on in people's lives today than the economic concerns, which are very salient in the data. There's no question about that. But on an array of other issues, and I think we saw this in Kansas recently, there are things that are very motivating to voters in the center. For example, independent voters in the survey we did together, Neil and I, and we do work together quite frequently, very strong on wanting to protect choice and a woman's right to choose. On tax fairness issues, they are closer to where Democrats are than where Republicans are. They don't think corporations need tax breaks. They think working people and average people do. So I think that, you know, we can say the economy is going to be front and center, but then which party is going to be able to make a values argument that's going to connect with those voters in the center, I think is a party that is going to do better. And I'm not sure that the Republicans are in that place, even on things like lowering the cost for prescription drugs, which and letting Medicare negotiate with Republicans, which Republicans just voted against, the biggest purchaser of prescription drugs in this country. And we're not going to let them negotiate the prices down for the American people, particularly seniors. It's absurd.
But
Joel,
go ahead,
even
Neil.
In our own polling, we showed Republicans with a 10-point advantage on rebuilding the economy. Republicans have a significant advantage on economic issues. And, you know, you want to, you know, bring all these other issues in, and certainly abortion is a key issue. But on pocketbook issues, we're going to have a significant advantage. And, you know, abortion's not going to be on the ballot as it was in Kansas in every other state in the country in November. It's going to be a key issue, but it's not on the ballot.
What about that?
Yeah, some of that's right, Neil. But I think how people define the economy in their own lives is going to be on the ballot. And I think when it comes to that, the point I'm making is they are more aligned with where Democrats are on issues, whether it's about prescription drugs, whether it's around tax fairness, and even issues like minimum wage and Fair Pay Act. I think that you can't just say the economy writ large is going to color everything. I think people are going to see their lives in this conversation and which party is going to convince them that they're going to do a better job, if you're a working or middle class American, of addressing the economic needs and pain points that I have. I think it's not crystal clear that Republicans have that advantage at all.
So, Neil Newhouse, how do you see Republicans adjusting their message to what happened in Kansas and, frankly, what Joel was just describing about these votes on lowering prescription drug prices?
Well, Judy, I think Americans want to see results. And the Biden administration's had a year and a half with complete control of Congress, and they finally get something done at the last minute. I think it's really too little too late. I think Americans want to have something in their pockets now. They are frustrated with the dysfunction in D.C. And the inability of the Democrats get their act together for, you know, over a year to get this done. So, you know, it's good that some of this stuff has passed, but, you know, you look at the rate of inflation. The previous segment talked about the Inflation Reduction Act. Just because they named it that doesn't mean that's what it's going to do. How do you spend trillions of dollars in government spending and reduce inflation? You know, I think Americans are going to see through a lot of this and come back to to a sensible conclusion in November.
And Joel, I want you to respond to that. And I mean, we did have a segment earlier in the program. William Brangham interviewed an economist talking about how people still feel, yes, the rate of inflation is slowing, but people are still hurting from high prices, especially people in the lower income brackets.
Well, they are. But we're also seeing some economic trends that are up. We've seen positive job growth. We've seen positive wage growth. I think I'm not a person who believes that the stock market is a measure of anything, but I think a lot of people are hearing, you know, better news on the macroeconomic front to some extent. I don't disagree with Neil on the point about inflation. All I'm saying is that when people make their choices on a personal level, there are an array of issues that connect with them viscerally, that are important to the values that they preach at home, that they preach in their churches and their synagogues. And I think this doesn't come down to the macroeconomic conversation that economists have. It has who's going to do a better job of protecting people like me, who may be living paycheck to paycheck, who are working hard for our money, and who's going to care more about the fat cats on Wall Street, if you will, in their vernacular that you hear in focus groups all the time. And I think that's a contrast between Democrats and Republicans. And I think we can have a macroeconomic debate, or we can have a debate about the economic lives of people. And I think people tend to trust Democrats more. And Neil and I have been in elections against each other sometimes where we had to make a case in a difficult economy. And it's by connecting with people's lives and values.
So I'm going to have to leave it there by saying this makes me want to come back to talk to you all again in good time before this election. Thank you so much, Joel Benenson, Neil Newhouse. Very good to see both of you. Thank you.
Thank you, Judy.
Shortly after Russia invaded Ukraine in February, some Ukrainians got tattoos to show support for their country. But as the war drags on, those patriotic symbols have become a liability. Special correspondent Simon Ostrovsky reports.
Olga Chumachenko is a customer support agent for a bank in Ukraine. When Russian forces swept through her hometown of Kherson 5 months ago, she wanted to show her support for her country.
I just wanted something that said I'm Ukrainian, and I'm proud of that on my body.
Her housemate, Alina Avi, was a tattoo artist, so Olha asked her to ink the word Ukrainian on her chest. She wasn't the only one. In the initial weeks of the Russian occupation of her city, Alina, who's since relocated to Germany, did dozens of Ukraine-themed tattoos for locals inspired by the war.
Ghost of Kyiv was tattooed. Persian watermelon on the hand of my friend. Tattoo with sunflower, because sunflower is one of the symbols of Persian. It was tattoos about Ukraine.
Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine 5 months ago awakened a sense of patriotism and pride in many Ukrainians, stirring some to commemorate those sentiments permanently in ink.
A lot of people came to get specifically patriotic tattoos. Some would get ears of wheat, some would get maps of Ukraine, some would get the colors of the Ukrainian flag. There were a lot of different things.
Olha even got a second tattoo on her wrist, the word home, with the letter O made out in the shape of her homeland, Ukraine.
We thought it would be over in a month, two max. We wanted to remember that moment. The emotions were so positive. It was like a gulp of normal life during occupation.
But hope that the Russians would leave quickly began to fade, and Olha realized that her new tattoos were putting her in danger.
I needed to go to the store. You go out for 5 or 6 hours, not one. You spend the whole time in long lines, and the whole time you're thinking, Lord, I hope nothing is showing or sticking out so they don't stop me and search me.
Valeria Solonets is a tattoo artist who's also from Kherson. She described hiding at home with her parents as Russian soldiers raided the apartment of her neighbor, a Ukrainian border guard.
They took out the computer processor and, of course, the household appliances. They had an electric cooker and a microwave, obviously. We saw them stealing the appliances with our own eyes.
But for some people, tattoos had become a liability, a mark they wanted to get rid of. Valeria received an unusual request from a client.
He was afraid to talk about it on the phone. He just said, I need a not good tattoo covered up.
Were you surprised when he came to you to ask to have his tattoo covered up?
I understood that it was a military tattoo. There are still partisans in the underground in the city, and they're being hunted. They're looking for them, as well as journalists. I didn't have any questions about the tattoo because it was military, and he could simply be killed.
Many of Alina's customers wanted to get out of the city and also worried that passing through multiple Russian checkpoints with tattoos that identified them as supporters of Ukraine would be dangerous.
The men were scared and wanted to get them covered up as quickly as possible because they understood that they were searched most often, and if you want to leave, you need to cover it up with something.
How did you feel when you were covering up your own tattoo artwork?
I was very angry about that. Not to that person. I was very angry to Russians.
Olha, fearing for her own life, made the painful decision to alter her tattoos too.
It was tough mentally. I felt that I didn't want to do it, but I had to. There were tears. It's really painful and looks like a fresh scar to me, but it will always remain in my heart and soul.
We tell our friends in the Ukrainian military and the security service the number and location of Russian vehicles so they know where to direct their fire.
Volodymyr, whose name we've changed, is part of the Ukrainian Territorial Defense Forces in hiding in Kherson. He switches apartments frequently in order to avoid detection by the Russian military.
There are a lot of searches. They need to show Nazis. They need to feed their audience and tell them that everyone here is a card-carrying member. If they find a person who has the kind of tattoo, they'll say, "Golly, looky here, we got another Nazi. Aren't we great?" So you have to be really careful with tattoos. Cover them up or ink them over. It's a real problem. There have been cases where people have been killed over tattoos in Kherson.
Human Rights Watch documented the torture of three members of the Kherson Territorial Defense Forces, who were POWs, in a report published last month. Two of them died. The report also documented 42 cases in which Russian occupation forces either forcibly disappeared civilians or held them arbitrarily, torturing many of them. Valeria felt it was time to escape the city, but she feared rape, or worse, if she was outed as a supporter of Ukraine.
When we decided to leave, I had to take a deep breath. I tried to dress as badly as possible. I gathered my hair into a bun and put on several shirts. No one paid any attention to me. A lot of people are getting raped.
It was scary when we were leaving because they undressed the men down to their underwear. With women, they would occasionally check their phones. When we were in line at one of the many checkpoints, some people got off the bus because it was hot and they wanted some fresh air, and they just started shooting their machine guns to force the people back on the bus.
Both Olha and Valeria managed to get out of Kherson and now live in cities that are still under Ukrainian control. But tens of thousands of Ukrainians remain in the city, too scared to leave or lacking the means to do so. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Simon Ostrovsky in Pervomaysk, Ukraine.
Across the country, tens of thousands of abandoned oil and natural gas wells sit idle. Known as orphan wells, they can pose a significant danger to the environment and to nearby residents. For more on this problem, we go to Stephanie Tsai.
Judy, wells are considered orphaned when they're forgotten or ignored by the companies that drilled them, often leaving a mess behind for states and taxpayers to clean up. For more, I'm joined by our community's correspondent, Robbie Chavez, who has been reporting on this from Louisiana. Robbie, it's great to see you. Let's just jump right in. What kind of specific dangers do these wells cause, and how far will this injection of federal funds go to help states clean them up?
Well, Stephanie, the impact is expected to be significant, especially to combat the growing danger of these abandoned wells. We already know the danger. Orphan wells can leak oil, brine, and other toxic chemicals, as well as emit methane, a greenhouse gas that harms air quality and contributes to climate change. They can also taint water sources and lower property values. Recently, there's been good news on the funding front. Billions of dollars of taxpayer money is being prepped to be sent to states to help address this problem. You might remember back in January, under the infrastructure law that was passed, there was $4.7 billion earmarked to combat this problem. Many states are now hoping it will help to cap tens of thousands of wells across the country.
And there are a lot of them. Where are all the wells located, and how have states dealt with cleaning them up in the past?
Well, look, every state is different. Louisiana, for example, has its own fund. Up until now, it's been funded by the oil and gas industry, but only a fraction of the money that's needed. In fact, the Louisiana legislative auditor said that it was no way enough money to keep up with the pace of the growing demand of these orphan wells. And officials believe this federal dollars coming to Louisiana will help them double the amount of money in this fund. As far as the rest of the nation is concerned, the Environmental Defense Fund has mapped some 81,000 orphan wells in 28 states. And according to that organization, 9 million people live within a mile of an orphan well. And according to an EDF analysis, it may take more money. It would cost, according to them, about $6 billion to plug all of these wells. Many of the states continue to look forward to this money coming their way to help address this problem. Take a look at this graph that we put together. Here are just the top 10 states with the largest amount of orphan wells. Pennsylvania has more than 27,000, followed by Ohio, Oklahoma, Kentucky, and Louisiana there rounds out the top 10.
I know you're on the ground reporting in communities in Louisiana. What kind of impacts have you been hearing about?
Well, Louisiana, as you just saw, has some 4,600 wells. The state tells me they've only been able to cap 100 to 200 wells per year. There are 230,000 people in the state that live within a mile of an orphan well, including 15,000 children under the age of 5 years old. As far as those federal dollars are concerned, Louisiana is expecting to get $111 million to try and tackle this problem. They expect that will be able to give them double the amount of wells that they're currently capping. It's a real problem, especially for people who live near these wells. We spoke with Ricky Jordan, who lives in Shreveport, Louisiana. Back in 2017, he uncovered an 83-year-old well in his backyard, right under the window where his daughter and granddaughter sleep. He reported it to the state. They have gone out and only partially fixed that problem. The well continues to poke out of the ground.
Back to the federal funding, though, Robbie, does this mean that taxpayers are now footing the bill for a mess that was really left by oil and gas companies?
Look, it depends who you talk to. The environmental activists say that by sending federal dollars, that they expect the number of abandoned oil wells, that number to explode now that federal dollars are coming their way. In fact, we've seen that already in Pennsylvania. The number of abandoned wells has grown by 200%. And in Oklahoma, the number of abandoned wells have grown by 1,500%. But if you talk to the oil and gas industry, they see this as a subsidy to help with this problem. They think it's a good thing, and they believe it will help put people to work. One way or the other, we expect that money to start flowing to the states by October, Steph.
Thank you. Robbie Chavez, PBS NewsHour's Communities Correspondent, reporting from Louisiana.
Thank you both. It is such an undercovered story, and you could read more of Robbie's reporting about orphan wells on our website. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.